hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Push Podcast. My name is Sydney. I'm a labor and delivery nurse.
I'm Megan. I'm an OBGYN and clinical researcher.
And today we are talking all about IUDs, which I'm so excited to talk about.
Sydney has been saying basically since we started the podcast that we need to do an episode on IUDs.
Yes.
And I think that brings us into our first big disclosure for this episode, right? Which is that we both are the proud owners of multiple IUDs.
Yes. I'm on number two here.
I'm also on number two IUD. Yeah. And so we are perhaps a little bit biased in this, in that it is the method of contraception that we both chose for ourselves.
Yes, exactly. And honestly, I will say you were the influence for me to actually get my first IUD. It was because I talked to you and I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. You convinced me and I'm very happy you did. I am.
I am a lot more aggressive with my counseling of friends and family members than I am with my patients, I must say. I'm probably a better clinician for my patients because I'm much more about, you know, informing their choices and making sure that they have everything open to them, and then stepping back and allowing people to make their own decisions. And with family members, I'm like, no, stop. Do this.
Yeah, exactly. No, but I'm happy you were, because sometimes you need that, right? So it was nice to have you available and at my disposal to just be like, help me. I need help. I need a good birth control form. And you gave me all the advice I needed. So
good. So thank you. I also made my sister get an IUD too.
Yes. I remember you telling me that. So hopefully we can talk about it today and maybe influence some of you guys that have been thinking about the IUD, but haven't like needed that little bit of a push. And maybe we can do that for you, or just go over the risks, the benefits, everything you need to know about IUDs. We're also going to, you know, break into some myths, online myths and misconceptions.
As always.
There's so much online, specifically with IUDs. And I know a lot of people out there have had a negative experience with IUD insertions. There's so many videos on TikTok with like people filming themselves getting the IUD inserted because it's so painful. And I really want to talk to you about what, you know, what options are out there for what pain management. What can we do? Yeah. Why isn't it routinely offered? Because I will say, like, my IUD was very painful to be inserted. Like, and I know that's not for everyone. Some people have a great experience, or especially if they've had children too, it seems to usually be a little bit easier. But other people, it can be really traumatizing. So we're going to go through all of that. So if this is something, a topic that interests you, hang in, watch this episode. You're going to love it.
Yeah. Welcome.
Yeah.
And on that note, Sid, too, I think like even more than like influencing people to get IUDs, what I really actually want to do, and I should say as well, from the get-go, as I have with like some other episodes where we've like danced around certain products and certain medications. Yeah. I'm actually not on any speaker boards for any of the companies that make IUDs. I'm not paid anything to talk about IUDs in general.
Which is very important to mention, right?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have literally no financial disclosures with respect to IUDs.
Yeah.
And so this is really just coming from the perspective of with a provider who puts in a lot of IUDs for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah.
And also, as somebody, I hope that we can kind of lend some personal experience to this too, as people who've gone through it a few times.
Yeah. I mean, you're in such a good position to talk about it because you not only have owned two IUDs, but you insert them on a regular basis as well.
Yeah.
So you can talk from the patient experience side and from the provider side, which is a really unique and like important perspective to have. So
totally. And on that note, like I think again, as opposed to influencing you guys to get one, because really, it's not the right contraceptive or method of like bleeding or pain management for everybody, right?
Yeah,
nothing is right for everybody.
Yeah,
but exactly. I do want to kind of like de-influence from the perspective of all of the misinformation that circulates online and all of the fear-mongering, I think, about IUDs too.
Yes.
Because I promise you, for like, I don't like to put my patients through pain. I don't want to start them on regimens for management of their periods in general that isn't going to work for them or help them.
Yes.
And so for every story that you hear online that has a negative experience, that's not to discount that experience, but rather to say there's 100 stories out there from people who love their IUD who just aren't motivated to talk about it.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So again, does not mean that people have not had bad experiences.
Yeah.
But I just want to kind of like dispel some of the fears and some of the worries that perhaps are not as rooted in you know, real facts or as rooted in something that is likely to happen to somebody, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
And then at the end of the day, if you guys don't want to get an IUD, at least you know a little bit more about them.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Which is always good to know what's out there and
nice to be able to articulate why it doesn't work for you.
Yeah. Exactly. Right? Exactly. So let's start from the very, very basic beginning of what an intrauterine device or IUD actually is, because for some people listening, they may have never actually heard of it before. Yes. And that's totally okay if that's you, but we're gonna break it down really simple on what it is. So why don't you explain?
So the intrauterine device, or IUD, again, is a, for the most part, again, in Canada and in the U.S., is a small T-shaped device that we insert in through the vagina, through the cervix, into the uterus, and it sits there and provides contraceptive benefit for an extended period of time. So it falls into the category of what we call forgettable contraception in Canada.
Yes, which is why I love it.
Now, this is not to be confused with other intrauterine devices, like the intrauterine ball, for instance, which has a few different formulations, one of which is available in Canada right now in a limited capacity.
Okay.
That basically is a string with several copper balls along it. These have different pros and cons. There's some suggestion that some of these devices are perhaps easier to insert, more difficult to have it, or easier to position it well, but perhaps have a higher rate of expulsion. And so I think that's kind of like a watch this space in Canada to see how this rolls out as we come to understand it a little bit better. And certainly there are other non-T-shaped types of devices that
in
are available
parts of the world.
Exactly, that have previously been available in North America and are currently available in other parts of the world. So intrauterine devices can take all sorts of different shapes and forms.
Yeah.
But in Canada currently, which is where we practice, the vast majority of intrauterine devices kind of follow this T-shaped pattern where the two horizontal arms kind of sit up towards the top of the uterus and the T coming down sits down kind of along the longitudinal axis of this of the uterus.
Yeah.
They all work a little bit differently, but primarily there's kind of two different kinds in Canada or two different categories, I guess, that we can initially separate them into.
Yeah.
One is a copper-containing IUD, and then one is a hormonal-containing IUD, which, again, in Canada, that hormone is levonorgestrel, which is an analog of like a progestin or like a synthetic progesterone.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but was the copper IUD the first IUD that was invented? Do you know that?
I actually don't know that, but you know what? I have been wanting to deep dive the, like,
to see
the history of IUDs because it is very interesting.
I don't know
and
why.
Very long
in my head, I feel like the copper IUD was like something that, you know, was used long before the hormonal IUD, but I have no idea. So I was curious if you
that
knew
sounds
that.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. But anyways, we'll go into the detail of what
that.
They are. I was
know
just
that
curious.
Off the top of my head. That's that is interesting.
Guys, she doesn't know everything. Oh my gosh.
At least we'll say what we do.
I'm just kidding.
You know what? I have taken the perspective and I guess the angle, like, and this goes for my clinical practice too, I feel like in subspecializing and in kind of sub-subspecializing, you just learn so much, how much nuance there is to everything. And it's made me so much more cautious to speak to things that, like, I don't know
you
the body
know.
Of literature really, really well. And so my, like, in practice, my angle usually is to just actually be, like, very upfront when I don't know things and even to look things up with my patients in the office because I have access to all sorts of different medical encyclopedias and, like, search engines that are medicine-derived that lay people can't access, that you have to pay, like, subscriptions or be part of an academic institution
to even
have access to. So I've kind of made a practice
of
doing
that. Like, if my provider was like, you know what? I actually don't know the answer to that question. Like, let's look it up together. I would feel way more at ease if they said that to me rather than maybe making up something that might not necessarily be true. You know what I mean? Like,
I hope that's the case.
Yeah.
You know what? I like, have just simply accepted I can't know all the things.
No, and, no one can.
No one can. And I even like to double check myself. Like, yep. I like to fact check myself in practice.
Even sometimes with these episodes, like, mm-hmm. we've gone back and had to fact check some things too, mm-hmm. and take it out of the episode. Or I've seen some podcasts that actually have a whole segment after on like fact checking what was said in the episode. And I love those, but let us know if that's something you'd be interested in.
Because I'm like, no, we have to cut that out. I think I didn't say that quite right. Or like, no, I didn't capture this nuance.
It's good. Cause we want our information on this podcast to be, of course, evidence-based and most relevant to what's going on in the world right now. So anyways, that's a little tangent, but let's go back to talking about the difference between the hormonal and the copper IUDs.
Yeah. Yeah.
So why don't we start with the copper IUDs?
Copper IUDs. Yeah. Sounds good. So copper IUDs, there are a variety of different versions that are available on the market, and the copper containing component can be on kind of a different area of the T, depending on the IUD that you have. Mm-hmm. I will say many contain somewhere in the realm of about 380 millimeters squared of copper. Mm-hmm. And again, they contain no hormone. Mm. So how do these actually work, right? Like, there's a lot of different information out there around like what is actually the mechanism of action for these.
Yeah.
And I should frame as well that as we're talking about, you know, quote unquote, how these work in this mm-hmm. episode, really what I'm talking about is how do they work to prevent pregnancy? Mm-hmm. When in reality as well, I'll be honest, I actually don't do a ton of contraceptive counseling in my mm-hmm. practice because most of my practice is surgical complex gynecology. And so but I do prescribe a lot of like hormonal IUDs, especially
for other reasons,
for heavy bleeding, mm-hmm. for painful periods. And mm-hmm. so this doesn't really speak to how these IUDs work for those reasons, mm-hmm. right? But if we're talking purely about preventing pregnancy, mm-hmm. The copper IUD works primarily through preventing fertilization. So preventing the sperm from being able to fertilize an egg.
Yeah.
And that is through kind of two different ways. It's through sperm mobility, motility, right? Mm-hmm. So the sperm's ability to like
move and get through.
Slither's actually a gross word. Like, I said that out loud and then I immediately disliked it.
But I feel like they slither. What else would they do? They swim.
But the sperm's ability to swim through the gynecologic tract in order to actually meet the egg, as well as viability and their ability to like actually then go through with the process of fertilization.
Yeah.
Okay. And the way that this happens is that copper ions are slowly released from the device, and these copper ions are actually toxic to the sperm. Mm. They create a bit of a local inflammatory response, mm-hmm. right? And that basically means that this entire gynecologic tract is just not supportive of sperm being at their best, right? And so they're swimming slower, they're not swimming quite as well, and then they're unable to go through with that process of fertilization, even when they meet egg.
Yeah.
And so again, it just kind of makes the uterus and the gynecologic tract a really hostile place mm-hmm. for the sperm to survive. Mm-hmm. Now, the hormonal IUDs, by contrast, work a little bit differently. So we have two major IUDs that contain levonorgestrel on the market in Canada. I'll briefly mention the brand names just so people know what we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
But again, framing here, like, it's just that there's only a couple available in Canada right now. I do not receive funding from any of these companies. Yeah. So Mirena is the first one. That's a levonorgestrel containing IUD, contains about 52 milligrams of levonorgestrel, so of the hormone, but it only releases about 20 micrograms per day.
Okay.
Kylina, conversely, has 19.5 milligrams of levonorgestrel, and it releases about 17.5 micrograms per day. Mm-hmm. Both the Kylina and the Mirena were initially marketed as five-year IUDs.
Yeah.
Now, the Mirena, over time, we've actually come to realize that its efficacy may be more in the 7 to 8 year range.
Yeah, much longer.
So much longer, which is nice for people, especially for those who are using it to treat bleeding, symptoms, painful periods, things like that. It's nice to know that this is not something that necessarily need be replaced you know,
every 5 years.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. We may have a little bit more time.
Yeah.
To leave that inside you, especially where it is, as we will discuss, not a comfortable procedure to have one inserted.
Exactly. Right? And when you say, you know, they expire or you need to get it replaced at that 5 to 7 year mark, is it just the amount of hormones that it's releasing has basically been used?
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
all it means.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They're no longer releasing hormones at the level that we would expect in order to reliably prevent pregnancy, which is again, kind of the main marketing mechanism for these, for these devices.
And the copper IUD, how long can that one stay? And that's a bit longer, right? 10 years?
Yeah. Depending on the IUD, either 5 or 10 years for the most part, depending on the brand that you use. And there are a few different brands of copper IUDs that are available in Canada.
Okay.
They'll work through the same mechanism though.
Okay. Okay.
Now the levonorgestrel IUD or the hormonal IUD works through a few complementary mechanisms. So where the copper is mostly just about making the environment toxic, right? The levonorgestrel is more about like several overlapping effects that it has that combined create a situation where someone is very unlikely to conceive a pregnancy.
Yeah.
So first and foremost, and kind of the main mechanism is through thickening of the cervical mucus. So that basically means that the sperm are unable to swim effectively through the cervical canal in order to enter the uterus where they'll then start to travel up through the fallopian tubes to meet the egg.
Yeah.
Okay. It also creates a bit of a reaction within the endometrium or the inner layer of the uterus and basically creates an environment where that endometrium becomes very, very thin and becomes less receptive to estrogen.
Yeah.
Now, if we remember back to our birth control pill episode where
we talked in detail
about the menstrual cycle.
Yeah, it's a great episode. It really helps you to understand your body on your period, which is so cool.
I feel like we didn't market that one enough as like also just a period episode because we do talk a lot in detail just about the menstrual cycle and the way that it works.
Yeah.
But in brief, the endometrium or the inner layer of the uterus needs to grow very big and thick in response to rising levels of estrogen so that it can potentially have a pregnancy implant. And it is then that thickened lining that sheds and gives us our period when no pregnancy implantation occurs.
Yeah.
And so basically, if that lining remains very thin and if it's a little bit more resistant to the effects of estrogen, then it becomes, again, a more difficult place for a pregnancy to implant.
To land.
And also has the side benefit of creating a much lighter period. Okay. They also, the levonorgestrel also impacts sperm capacitation, which basically is, again, the process by which sperm acquire the ability to fertilize an egg. So sperm aren't just like, it's not just quite as simple as like they just pew through the egg and then fertilization occurs. They actually have to undergo a change whereby they're able to penetrate that egg.
Yeah.
And it impacts their ability to do so.
To be able to do that.
Exactly. The levonorgestrel also does suppress ovulation in some people, although this is not the primary mechanism by which it prevents pregnancy. And I will say it's only really about 50% of people with the Mirena specifically in which ovulation is suppressed. And so many people do actually continue to ovulate with the levonorgestrel IUD inside you. And then the last thing too, and this is not, again, like a primary mechanism, but both IUDs actually do slow tubal motility. So what this means is that the fallopian tubes are actually full of tiny microscopic cilia, like little tiny hairs that kind of just wave in the breeze and brush that egg
down the fallopian tube.
I'm picturing like a beach with like beach grass, right?
That's
like flowing back and forth.
Yeah.
And so it helps the tube to, or the egg to kind of travel down the fallopian tube and it slows that process quite a bit.
Yeah.
So again, not a like, this is not the process by which we hang our hats on to prevent pregnancy.
Yeah.
But it is one of the layered effects that kind of contributes to an overall situation where pregnancy is very unlikely to occur. Okay.
So now that we know exactly what the different types are, what they do and all that kind of stuff, let's kind of dive into the actual insertion and the process that, you know, what it feels like, you know, if it hurts, if it goes well, if it doesn't, all that kind of stuff. Because I know this is probably the part that a lot of people are listening to this episode for,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes, yeah,
coming from a bad experience themselves or maybe just worried because they've seen bad experiences online. Yeah. So let's, you know, let's go through exactly what happens when you go and have an IUD inserted. Mm-hmm. And I think we can both talk on our own personal experiences, but why don't you first talk about what you do, what you consult your patients for, what the procedure looks like, if do they need to take a whole day off of work, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I will say like pain is multifactorial, right? Yeah, and as somebody that tackles a lot of complex pain in my practice, that's the first thing that I have to kind of lay out on the table is that people feel pain very differently. And pain is an experience that is dictated by a ton of different factors, right? Yeah. Even for something as like, quote unquote, simple as like a procedure, right? Mm-hmm. Like an IUD insertion. So pain's impacted by a ton of different things. Mm-hmm. But broadly speaking, kind of how I often talk to my patients about the pain associated with an IUD insertion is that there's kind of like three windows of pain or three areas of the insertion by which people can experience pain for kind of very different reasons, right?
Yeah.
I would say the first one is the speculum in and of itself.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So in order to put in an IUD as a provider, I have to be able to see the cervix so that I can safely guide the instruments through the cervix and into the uterus in order to put that IUD in.
Yeah.
And what that means is I need to use the tool called a speculum, which is kind of the duck-billed device. Looks like this.
Yeah.
I should have a speculum here that I can use for demonstration.
I have some. Well, now in LA, but I do have some. But yeah, you should bring some in. Bring some demonstration tools.
I should bring some demo tools in.
I even want to see a little IUD. Do you have like one of those fake IUDs?
Oh, I have like 6 fake IUDs somewhere in my house in boxes. I know.
It's okay.
I know. I guess that is compensation maybe that I've gotten from drug companies over the years is they do tend to give like little lanyards with fake IUDs on them.
Yes, I've seen them all the time.
I always think they're so cute, so I always pick up a bunch of them. I have been compensated at like conferences and stuff.
Okay, well, once you find one, you need to make a video showing
IUDs
it.
That I think are really cute.
Yes, because they're so little. They're cute.
So the speculum, this duck-billed device, kind of has two articulating, like long
levels.
I don't want to use the word blades because that sounds so aggressive.
Yes, I see what you mean. Yeah,
but like
tongues. They look like little tongues. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah,
that open kind of in one direction, up and down, and that pushes the front and back walls of the vagina away from one another, so that I'm able to see the cervix, which is kind of like the little donut shaped doorway between the vagina and the uterus at the very back of the vagina.
And some of you guys may have experienced this already from a pap test because that's usually what you use is the same that's the speculum for the pap test.
Exactly. Exact same
so exact tool. Same thing.
Now, some people don't mind a speculum exam.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
For some people, it doesn't really bother them. For others, just the insertion of the speculum can be really painful, right?
Some people have told me it's the worst part.
100%. And so this is kind of, again, where we get into like an IUD insertion is not just as simple as like it sucks or it doesn't suck, right? Like the ways in which it can suck vary wildly depending on people's individual anatomy and their past experiences. And so some of the reasons why I've seen that people have difficult IUD insertions.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's things like vaginismus, vulvodynia, or like painful vagina disorders, right? Painful vulva, painful vagina disorders.
Yeah.
Some people sometimes have dermatologic conditions, like lichen sclerosis that can make either the opening narrow or again, a little bit more sensitive and painful to examine. For women who have lower estrogen levels, who've perhaps gone through premature menopause, or women who are perimenopausal, getting an IUD for other reasons, right? For things like bleeding or as the progestin component of hormone replacement therapy. Sometimes we can have atrophy or thinning of the vaginal tissues secondary to menopause, right? And that can make an insertion of an IUD really uncomfortable for people.
Yeah.
And then other people have more broad pelvic floor dysfunction, right?
Yeah.
The pelvic floor is this grouping of muscles that's responsible for so much within the pelvis.
Yes.
I think it doesn't get nearly enough attention with respect to the way that it can impact all sorts of different aspects of our menstrual and reproductive function.
Yeah.
And certainly hypertonic pelvic floor, so muscles that are really, really tight or really, really sensitive can make it really difficult for people to undergo a speculum exam.
Yeah.
So first and foremost, the ways that we can account for that in pain management are things like choosing a smaller or thinner speculum. Most gynecologists you'll find will use thin as small a speculum we can.
Yeah.
And I do find in what I often teach my residents and my medical students even who come to work with me is that you can almost always use a much smaller speculum mm-hmm. than you think you need. Mm-hmm. And so I always start small and work my way up if I need something a little bit bigger as opposed to kind of going the other way, especially yeah. if somebody, and I always ask people
yeah.
how speculum exams are for them.
Yeah, before so that you mm-hmm. know. Yeah, that's such an important question to
yeah.
ask. You
yeah.
know? Yeah.
And then the last thing as well I would say too with respect to like pain with speculums is trauma.
Yeah.
I've had people who have experienced like trauma mm-hmm. from previous speculums. And mm-hmm. it makes them so afraid and so tense prematurely yeah. before we even start the exam.
Yeah.
That can't be
no.
ignored.
Yeah.
Very early on in my training, I had a patient who I really was getting a sense. I thought she must have had some sort of sexual trauma
yeah.
that she experienced because of how horrible I could see even approaching the concept of an exam was making her feel.
Was making her anxious.
I could just tell there was a trauma response that was starting to yeah. happen. And yeah. when I sat down to have a little bit, like I stopped everything. We sat down yeah. to have a little bit more of like a fulsome conversation about what she was experiencing and mm-hmm. how I could, you know, better approach it. It came out that it was a speculum exam.
Yeah.
Had caused her that trauma.
Especially if she had the provider who didn't take
yeah.
the time
exactly.
to explain it and just kind of rammed it in her.
Exactly.
And, you know, that can be, I know for a lot of you listening, maybe you've yeah. had that same experience. And
yeah.
I'm sorry that was your experience. Yeah. That should never
A speculum be. Exam can be traumatizing.
Yeah.
And that was like a huge, like, game changer in yeah. my early learning because I really had not conceived of it
yeah.
in that way before. And
yeah.
and I'm so much more, I would have hoped that I'd be sensitive anyway, but I'm so cognizant of
Even
that
more.
Now.
Yeah. Yeah,
So number one thing, the speculum can be bad. But
yes.
for some people, again, if you're sitting here going, well, I've never actually minded my pap test.
Yeah.
Then phase one of the IUD.
Check. You know what
probably
to
not going
to
be an issue for you, yeah. in which case, amazing.
And
right?
just so you guys know too, mm-hmm. for every pap test or anything mm-hmm. that involves a speculum, we use a lot of lubricant as well.
Yes.
So that will
yes.
hopefully help yeah. to minimize the discomfort of the actual insertion of the speculum.
Yeah.
Of course, there's still going to be some discomfort, but at least you know there will be lubricant.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the next part, if you can kind of imagine with me, we have the speculum in. It is open.
Yeah.
Our patient is doing well. I can now see the cervix.
Mm-hmm.
The next part is going to be guiding our instruments through the cervical canal so mm-hmm. that we can reach the uterus, which is the organ kind of at the other end of this long tubular structure
yeah.
called the cervix, right?
Yeah.
And so there's a few different things that we may need to do in the context of that, right? Mm-hmm. Number one, sometimes if the cervix is very, very tight, mm-hmm. right? If the hole is very small, if it's difficult to kind of see the pathway that we're going to go through or manipulate it, mm-hmm. we sometimes have to put on an instrument called a tenaculum,
mm-hmm.
which I will acknowledge is like a very aggressive looking instrument.
Yes. There's videos online of it.
I'm sure.
It looks yeah. very scary. It
does. Looks very scary. It looks yeah. very scary.
Yeah.
So basically we use it to hold on to the cervix.
Yes.
So that we're able to straighten the canal because mm-hmm. sometimes the cervix kind of curves up in one yes. way or the other.
Yeah.
And so that we can cross that threshold of the yeah. cervix a yeah. little bit more easily.
Yeah.
I don't habitually put it on for every single IUD I do. Usually okay. I see if I can cannulate the cervix without okay. it first,
okay.
especially for somebody who's like had a vaginal delivery before, mm-hmm. right? Or somebody for whom this is potentially going to be a little bit of an easier insertion.
Right, yeah.
But I warn all my patients that we may require a tenaculum.
A tenaculum, yeah.
Exactly. And now this is an area, this like cervical manipulation mm-hmm. is an area where I feel like both kind of medical providers who've trained recently and also patients are being gaslit a little bit mm-hmm. because there's this narrative that the cervix doesn't have nerves. Have you read
yes.
this?
Oh yeah. my goodness.
Or have you seen this?
So yeah. I actually posted a video mm-hmm. after I got my second IUD because I yeah. was, I think it was the first year that I was started social media.
Yeah.
So I documented the process of me yeah. getting my IUD.
Yeah.
Not the actual insertion. I didn't record that, but just mm-hmm. come with me to go get yeah. an IUD yeah. changed
yeah.
or whatever.
Yeah.
And I posted that video and I almost fainted during my IUD, my second IUD, not the first, but the second one. I had a full like syncopal, like vasovagal response after my cervix was manipulated, and which is very common. We'll get into that after. Yeah. But so I posted that online, and everyone was, you know, saying that, you know, it's not even like there's no nerve endings in the cervix. There's nothing that should be causing you pain. And I was like, really? And so then I started doing some research, and anyways, I found a lot of stuff online saying two different things. Some people were like, absolutely, the cervix has nerve endings. And then some people were saying, actually, the cervix has no nerve endings. So you should,
it's silly to say that the cervix has no nerve endings. That's anatomically incorrect.
What?
Also, like, basically everything has nerve endings.
Literally,
right?
All I was saying was like, it was painful for me.
I think, so here is where I think, and to be fair, like, as someone who trained somewhat recently, I also was kind of taught that the cervix doesn't feel pain. That's more like the language that was used as I was going through.
Does that come from lack of like studies on women's bodies in general?
No. So I think it comes from like a fundamental misunderstanding of the nervous system, right? Okay. And like what we're talking about.
Okay.
I also, though, was taught that it is very common to have a vasovagal episode or to have like stimulation of the vagus nerve, basically.
Yeah, when there's cervical.
When the cervix is manipulated. Yeah. And we know that. That happens. Like, that is well established. So again, the cervix is like obviously neurologically connected.
Yes.
Right? Like, it's silly to say it's not.
Yeah.
Because we also, out of the other side of our mouth, say that, like, it is very likely that you may feel nauseous, you may feel fainty, you may even faint when we manipulate the cervix for any number of reasons, right? Yeah. So here's kind of, I think, where we're all, where there's a little bit of miscommunication.
Yes.
The cervix does not contain the kind of sensory nerves that feel pain quite as distinctly as our skin.
Right.
Right? So that kind of touch temperature sensation
that
you
different.
Would feel in other areas or even in the vagina itself, the cervix doesn't have those kinds of nerves.
Okay.
But it is rich in nociceptors or in these like deeper sensory nerves that respond to things like stretching and pulling and pressure, right? And so you absolutely can experience pain and discomfort associated with the manipulation of the cervix because those nerves are stimulated, right?
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of people's experiences. They say the pain that they felt from the insertion was different than any pain they've ever felt before. Mm-hmm. And it's probably for that reason.
In
it's different nerves that are being stimulated. Maybe. I don't know. Like, there's probably still outside nerves that are being stimulated, but it could be that too, right?
Yeah. So that, I think, is kind of like where both sides are right a little bit in this, in that, like, again, the cervix doesn't feel pain the way our skin feels pain.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But it is not without nerves.
Okay.
Right? Like, it is not without nerve endings. And in fact, it is rich in a variety of different connections to our neurological system that do feel sensory, like that have sensory input.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that is, again, that's, I think, where we're all kind of losing the thread a little bit with respect to the cervix itself.
I was curious if it was true. I know at the time I just couldn't find a straight answer of if it was or wasn't true.
Yeah.
But, and then I was kind of diving into, well, is this just lack of research on a woman's body, right? And pain related to the woman's reproductive system. But it makes sense what you're saying. It's different nerves, but they still
different. Again, both are true, right? Like, both are true. The cervix does not feel pain the same way as other structures, and yet you can still feel pain associated.
Yeah.
Different does not mean no pain.
Yeah.
Right?
And I think that's where people maybe went wrong, was saying, well, you know, even though it's different, like, that just means there's no, you won't feel any pain. And it's, but then there's hundreds of cases of patients saying, well, no, I felt pain.
Yeah.
And to me, that means that.
Did they put a tenaculum on your cervix when you did your IUD? What did it feel like to you, Sid?
For me, I'm trying to remember. I feel like I've like blurted out in my brain because it was traumatic, if I'm being honest. But it felt like pressure to me. Like it felt like pressure.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say I felt like because I've seen a tenaculum.
Yeah.
Like I work in this area. It's like it's two pointy little, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
They're two pointy little metal tongs almost.
Yeah.
And to me, that looks like it would feel sharp.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And it just felt like a very uncomfortable pressure to me.
Yes. Yeah.
But mixed with some cramping. That was also, because I'm sure there was multiple things happening at once. So I don't know. the OB I went to, she did it very, very quickly. I'll give her that. Yeah, so I don't know if she did things very fast. I don't know exactly, but to me it felt like just like a deep pressure sensation.
Yeah.
And I didn't like it. Like, I wouldn't say it was pleasant.
Yeah. You know, I had a really similar experience in that, I did not feel sharp.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think that that is like an important qualifier if we're thinking about like how scary that instrument looks.
Yes.
Is that I actually didn't feel sharp. Like I didn't feel a piercing sensation.
Yeah.
Which again, I think speaks to those nerves, right? Like that the absence of the same kind of sensory nerves that would feel like sharp pain on our skin.
Yeah. Yeah.
However, I will say it made me feel immediately nauseous.
Same.
Right. Which again goes a little bit to that vasovagal response.
Yeah.
And it also felt wrong.
Yeah.
And that is like, it's not, I realize it's not a good descriptor, but I have said that to my own patients before in that like, it just felt, it wasn't pain, but it was like a weird discomfort. I did not like it.
Okay.
And it felt wrong that it was on my cervix.
Did you have, did they use a tenecalum for both IUDs that you've had? Or have you had one versus the other?
My postpartum IUD was such a different experience.
It's just
I
not
literally
even comparable.
Couldn't tell you. It wasn't even comparable.
Yeah.
It wasn't even comparable.
Fair. Because I know with my, sorry, we're getting into a tangent here, but like with my first one, I was actually on my period when I had my first one inserted and it was night and day difference.
Yeah.
I felt way better.
So much
and
better.
I don't know if they used a tenecalum at that time. I'm going to guess they didn't.
Yeah.
Because potentially my cervix was
maybe
slightly more, like they might not have needed to. And it was way better.
Way better.
Like way better.
Yep, yep,
I didn't get that sensation of nausea and wanting to pass out. I didn't get that at all.
That's so good.
So,
that's so good.
I don't know. Everyone's experience is so different. Like, you know, I can talk for hours about mine and you can talk about yours and then yours will be so different. It's hard to say, but it's interesting to hear our perspectives on what that tenecalum actually felt like.
And again, I think that's an important qualifier as we're talking about this, like, pain, no pain associated with the cervix concept, right? So then the last area that we can feel pain is the uterus itself, right?
Yeah.
The uterus is a big muscle and we can get into the details, but like ultimately it's a big muscle that hates everything. It hates any kind of distension, any pressure inside of it.
Yes.
It hates it.
Yes.
And its main response to things it hates is to contract.
And
to cause this cramping sensation.
Yeah.
And so that is the one area that is a little bit harder to target, as we'll talk about like pain control. But certainly like as we cross the barrier of the internal os of the cervix, so kind of the inner doorway of the cervix, we're entering into the uterus. The uterus feels stretch, it feels distension, and it causes cramping. And so it's very common and in fact expected that people experience like a very sharp uterine cramp at that time.
Yeah. Not just the, ooh, there might be a little cramp here.
Yeah.
Which is what my OB said. Yeah. I was like, girl, that ain't a little cramp.
Then the last area, there's like a bonus fourth area, I think, that contributes to pain. And I'm going to try and like explain this in a way that feels like, I feel like this is a hard thing to explain in a way that doesn't feel like like it's putting blame somehow on patients. And so I really hope that you guys listening know that that is like not how I think or feel. But the pain experience is influenced by more than just like the mechanics, right? It's also really experienced, or it's really influenced by psychosocial factors, right? And like our anticipation of pain.
Yeah.
Actually can change our literal experience of pain, right?
Yeah.
And so multiple studies have found that people for whom the anticipatory fear is really, really high, our anticipation of pain, that they invariably have higher pain scores, right? At the time of insertion. And that is not, and this is where, again, I think that sometimes we like end the conversation there and it makes people feel like, oh, okay, well, you're blaming me for being scared, or you're saying that because I'm scared, I have a lower pain threshold. And that's really not it, but it's that all of these things, anxiety, fear, previous experiences, they modulate the pain pathways in our brain, right? So they actually impact, they have the ability to amplify or dampen the way that we feel pain. And so it's really not about like someone's pain threshold. And it's not about you being like too scared to go through with it. It's that fear, anxiety, and our past experiences shape the way that we experience pain in a very real way.
And we see that all the time for me in labor and delivery.
Like, exactly.
This happens with anything. So it, like, it, Yeah.
In many ways, it's a protective reflex, right? 100%. Like it's a protective reflex that our bodies and our brains have developed. But I think that's part of why, part of my job as somebody who inserts a lot of IUDs is to help the person I have in front of me stay as relaxed and as calm as possible. Mm-hmm. Whether that means explaining things to them as we go, whether that means allowing them to put on music or podcasts, whether that means having a support person there for comfort.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is all like part actually of the 100%. Like pain treatment of all of this. And it's not to say that we can't or shouldn't do other things too to help with pain at the time of an IUD insertion, but those things are really important too.
And they
like
can
the
help.
Social comfort, counseling parts, right? Are like, honestly, as important as anything that I would like inject or prescribe or do anything like
and
that.
And breathing, like making sure, you know, you're taking a big deep breath and you're actually oxygenating, because a lot of people hold their breath when they're in pain, right? Yeah, we see that all the time with with vaginal exams, right? Yeah. It's like you tense up because you're so scared, and then that just makes everything hurt even more. Mm-hmm. So you may have heard from exams in the past, you know, your provider saying, just relax, which is like the hardest thing to hear when you're clearly not relaxed. But that's why you might hear your provider say those things to you, is because you're trying to relax your body, relax your pelvic floor, relax your nervous system, so that hopefully the procedure is a slightly less painful.
Yeah.
Of course, maybe there's better words to use than just relax, but
like you said,
counseling beforehand and doing all those kinds of things can be really helpful.
Now, what can we do to change the way that someone might experience pain during this, right? Like what can we do to better treat pain during an IUD insertion? Mm-hmm. So again, thinking of kind of those like four areas, right? Mm-hmm. Number one, with the speculum exam, we've kind of talked about this already, but we can choose a small speculum. We can have this inserted with a skilled provider, right? And that means gynecology for some cases, but that also can mean a skilled family practice or general provider as well, right?
Yeah, or there are nurse many, practitioner too,
nurse
right?
Nurse practitioner, mm-hmm. absolutely. There are many nurse practitioners, family doctors that are like as skilled, if not more so than many gynecologists, right? Or many obstetricians.
Yeah.
In fact, many of the tips and tricks that I've learned about putting in IUDs, I've learned from family doctors during like the early phases of my training.
Yeah.
And so again, experience is kind of the thing that I'm harping on here. It doesn't necessarily need to be somebody in my field.
Yes.
Helping people coach through relaxing the pelvic floor, as Sydney has implied. So tensing the pelvic floor during a speculum exam means those muscles within the pelvic floor kind of contract around the tool itself.
Yeah.
And that sense of pressure actually creates a lot more pain than it solves. It's your body's natural response. It's not anything that like somebody's purposefully doing.
Yeah.
But often that's where I find too our role, or I often have a nurse assistant. My nurse's role often is to coach and talk through the patient through pelvic floor relaxation.
Yep.
And again, that's not because people are babies. That's because it's part of our job, right? Like that it should be an expected part of this procedure is to help people relax their pelvic floor and to be patient as those muscles relax.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it comes to the cervix, that's where there's like some interesting debate about pain management in general.
Yeah.
Now, I've seen a lot of back and forth about freezing the cervix online.
Cervical block,
And I'll be perfectly honest, in my training, especially my early training, a narrative that I think was perpetuated a little bit in earlier days was that the block was as painful as the insertion.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that too.
Now, I must say that's been a bit debunked.
Okay.
Right? That's been a bit debunked through multiple systematic reviews. Mm-hmm. So multiple high-level studies that have looked at, and multiple randomized control trials too, right? Okay. Have looked at, does insertion of any kind of freezing to the cervix improve the experience and decrease the pain scores of people who are undergoing an IUD insertion? And without getting into the details of every single study, which I, you know, I come with like
she did, guys.
A stupid amount of notes on all the studies. But kind of summarizing them honestly is that like it does decrease IUD insertion pain.
Because for those of you who haven't had any kind of lidocaine injection before, I always use the example of being at the dentist, right? And if you get freezing before you have a cavity filled, that's the freezing. So it burns. Like it burns for a few seconds and then it becomes numb. So you do have to experience a little bit of pain before you actually experience the numb sensation, right?
Yeah.
So I understand why they studied it then, right? And why that was the initial thought process.
Totally. Now I will say there's some debate in our field about like what is the best way to freeze the cervix. Mm-hmm. There are lidocaine sprays that can be sprayed onto the cervix. There's a lidocaine cream that's been studied.
Yeah.
There are different ways that you can do a cervical block. Mm-hmm. So when we actually like inject with a needle lidocaine in and around the cervix, there's some debate about what the best technique is for that, whether it's intracervical or paracervical block. But suffice to say, it appears that all of these forms of freezing the cervix have been shown to decrease the pain that somebody experiences. And truthfully, what's available to anyone looking to get an IUD as far as like the quote unquote best method of freezing the cervix, it also might be a little bit like dependent on what's available in that clinic.
Gotcha.
But most clinics should have and do have available. Some form of cervical freezing available to you. And you certainly wouldn't be... Like, you'd be well within your rights to request a cervical block, I would think, of some form. And again, it's evidence-based. It has been shown to decrease pain scores associated with IUD insertion in some, like, quite well-designed RCTs.
So, guys, for everyone listening, if your provider says that it isn't well-studied or it isn't...
Actually, it's pretty well-studied.
It is, okay? But I'm just saying that because I've heard stories online of patients asking for freezing and then providers saying, well, actually... It's going to cause you more pain. Like, it's going to be quicker if we just do the insertion. That is old evidence. So I would suggest maybe finding a different provider in that case.
There are very good studies that do support freezing the cervix at time of IUD insertion. Now, I will say I offer it to my patients.
Yeah.
So some people have really strong feelings about having their cervix frozen or having like a needle going into that area.
Yeah.
And I will say, too, for some people, speed is actually the thing that they're looking to optimize.
Yep.
And so for those people, sometimes it is better to not do a cervical block, right? But usually I just explain the pros and cons. I offer it to everybody.
Yeah.
And some of my patients say, you know what? No. Like, again, the main downside I would say is speed. It takes up a little bit of time. And so for people who want to get in and out as fast as possible, then some of my patients choose to forego the cervical block. Yeah. And I think that that's perfectly reasonable. Yeah. But I pretty strongly feel it should be offered to everybody.
It's our job to be able to explain all of your options, and then you can make an educated decision for yourself, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, what's not effective at this point for the cervix itself? Misoprostol is a medication that we used to actually recommend pretty routinely, or people did recommend pretty routinely. It's a prostaglandin analog, and so it actually works to soften the cervix and open it up a little bit.
Yes, we did talk about it briefly in our induction of labor part one episode.
Exactly.
So it is used for induction of labor as well.
For a lot of many things. Mm-hmm. So many things. But it isn't necessarily shown to be very effective at reducing pain associated with IUD insertion. Now, there's still a role for misoprostol, particularly for people who have not had like a failed insertion, right? Mm-hmm. So for people whom we haven't been able to pass the cervix, there is potentially a role for misoprostol in those cases in kind of a specific context.
Okay.
But routine misoprostol is not shown to decrease the amount of pain in an IUD placement, and in fact can increase pre-placement abdominal pain, cramping, and sometimes diarrhea as well, right?
But that used to be more routine, right?
I do think it used to be more routine. By the time I was coming through, we weren't necessarily doing it routinely.
Okay.
But I have certainly heard lots of stories of people having it done routinely. And again, I don't think that that is like representative of like, you know, bad choices. I just think that it is, we've come to understand a lot more about these kinds of things. And really, again, like we've confirmed this even as recently as 2025, right? With a Cochrane review that looked at whether misoprostol was helpful or not and was shown that it wasn't. So,
interesting. I mean, I've had IUDs, like my first IUD was inserted, oh gosh, I don't know, but it's been like 7 years, I think now. And I was never offered it at that time, but I had friends who were given it.
Misoprostol.
So it, I don't know, kind of a gray area, I guess. But
again, not something that I had never used, right? And especially like there is evidence for an increase in success in placement, potentially, if in somebody that you weren't able to go through their cervix previously. So if you're going to make a second attempt in clinic, or even in the OR, then misoprostol is reasonable from that perspective.
Okay, good to know. Now,
with respect to that last area of pain, the uterus, there's not a ton that we can do to improve the pain with the uterus. So the freezing that I can put into the cervix isn't necessarily going to freeze the uterus itself. And there's no way for me to do a block for the uterus, really, in clinic.
Yes.
So then we're left with things like oral analgesia, right? Mm-hmm. Garden variety ibuprofen, not actually shown to be helpful. Although we often recommend it as like a low harm kind of intervention.
Yeah.
A little bit better evidence for anti-inflammatories like naproxen or even pain medications like tramadol.
Yes.
To decrease the amount of pain that somebody experiences without like uterine cramping itself.
Yes.
But then from that perspective, kind of the last, I think, vestige of like pain management would be anesthesia.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And there's certainly a role for inserting IUDs in the OR.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
The one downside, I think, in Canada, the one pitfall that people often find themselves falling into is just OR availability.
Yeah.
Right? It's an easy procedure to do in the OR.
Yeah.
I would say many OBGYNs are very happy to do an IUD in the OR. It's just that we are in a system limited where we have resources. Limited OR time. Mm-hmm. And it might mean that someone has to wait a lot longer for the OR than they would if they were doing it in clinic, right? In clinic, I can do it as soon as you can get the prescription filled for the IUD.
Yes.
The OR can sometimes take even, you know, up to a year, right? Or more, months, depending on the provider.
Absolutely.
And so that is just the reality of the situation in Canada, but certainly is not a reason to not get one inserted in the OR if you feel like very strongly that that is the best method for you, right?
Now, my sister, and I know she'd be okay with me saying this, but she recently had her IUD inserted and she was offered a medication that you inhale.
Yes. Yeah. So that we do have some, so there have
been. It was new, right? Like it's at least in Canada. Yeah, I don't know.
It's called Penthrox in Canada. Yeah. And it is an inhaled anesthetic that is shown to be quite safe to be used in clinical settings. Mm-hmm. We are still looking at like the evidence for IUDs specifically is obviously emerging, right? With inhaled medications like that, or even like laughing gas.
Yeah. For instance, nitrous oxide.
Has been like, has been studied in some contexts.
Yeah.
I would say it seems very reasonable that that would be a great
adjunct. You get that at the dentist.
Right?
Well, you get totally. Yeah.
The clinic where I'm practicing right now, where the clinic rules are that we're not able to use Penthrox. But I know of lots of people who are in their clinics and anecdotally are having really nice experiences with IUD insertions with them. And I'm really glad that you brought that up. I actually meant to mention that, like, hopefully we're going to have more guidelines around them. I just don't have like the data to
support it right now.
Well, just to recount to people, right? But certainly it seems anecdotally in practice that the data will be in support.
I would imagine. And I would encourage like our listeners to ask about
100%,
it because my sister, what she did was she asked if there was any pain management options. And then the OB she went to said, oh, you know what? We're doing Penthrox now. She did have to pay out of pocket for it. Yeah. So at least in Canada where we have universal healthcare, most of this is covered. But for her, she did have to pay out of pocket for it. So that's just something to consider. It is an additional cost, unfortunately, if you are doing, there's more medication involved, right? But from her experience, she said it was very helpful. So, I mean, that for me, that's enough of a study to be like, okay, I have one person who said it was very helpful because she'd had a previous IUD without anything. Yeah. And she said it did help. She still felt the pain.
Yeah.
Like I went with her and she still like, you could still see there was discomfort involved. Yeah. It didn't completely take over. I think the only way to completely feel nothing would be to go under anesthesia. But she said, I would do that again.
She would do that again.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
So anyways.
Yeah. Well, and you being there as well goes to, again, that kind of last area that we'll just repeat now, right? Which is like the psychological component of pain and treating that as well as, and considering like the experience and what people are thinking and feeling as they approach the insertion as being just as important to pain management as anything that we could prescribe or inject.
Absolutely.
Right? So having a support person there, listening to music. There's actually been like studies that have looked at like listening to music in association with painful procedures.
And so, tense machines too, I've heard, specifically for IUD insertions. Mm-hmm. Which makes sense, right? It, we use them in labor all the time.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Yeah. Talking through things, mm-hmm. you know, having good coaching available.
Yes. And, you mm-hmm. know, even going back to my sister's experience, but her first IUD was inserted during COVID when mm-hmm. there was no support people allowed to come. Yeah, right. Yeah. So that could have been a large part of it too. Right. So there's so many factors to consider, but
yeah,
bring someone with you, bring someone who make it, whether I've gone with like so many of my friends to get there. I'm always open to hold their hand and be there for them. Go get a fun drink afterwards, drive them just in case, even though they can drive. You know, like I'm there to be a support person.
I think you should get an IUD treat after you have an IUD inserted.
Yes.
I think that should be like, honestly, we should partner. We should get some sort of partnership with some sort of like treat store.
Mandatory ice cream trip after. Non-negotiable.
Exactly.
For sure.
So listen, Sid, I think you have some, we've kind of talked about through like what they are.
Yes.
How the insertion happens and then some ways that we can control pain at the time of insertion.
Yes.
What are some like myths and misconceptions that you hear online, even outside of the ones that we've already addressed?
Yeah. Okay. The biggest one mm-hmm. that I want to talk about is IUDs cause infertility or fertility issues. True or false?
Definitely false. There is no evidence that modern IUD devices carry with them any increased risk of infertility. Mm-hmm. So those are specifically, again, the devices that we've talked about today that mm-hmm. are on the market in Canada specifically. Mm-hmm. And this is evidence from multiple high-level, high-quality studies and clinical guidelines. Mm-hmm. So they've shown that both copper and levonorgestrel IUDs are not associated with impaired fertility and no mm-hmm. increased need for assisted reproductive technologies or like IVF, mm-hmm. you know, medications that are prescribed by fertility doctors or anything like that. Large studies have shown that the pregnancy rates after IUD discontinuation are quite comparable to the general population or very comparable. Okay. And fertility returns actually rapidly after removal.
Okay.
However, there is a historic nugget of truth to mm-hmm. this, right? Mm-hmm. So there definitely were previous experiences with older IUDs that are now off the market that did show an increased risk of infertility. And the Dalkon Shield is kind of the like classic example of that, right? Yeah. Which is withdrawn from the market due to its association specifically with pelvic inflammatory disease mm-hmm. or infections that can cause things like tubal infertility or fallopian tubes that are blocked, not able to work any longer.
Yeah.
Again, modern copper and modern hormonal IUDs have not been shown to increase this risk.
Okay. That's good to know. Mm-hmm. It's a valid concern that I feel
super
like
valid concern. Have. Well, and again, as with so many things, like even things that we say are myths, often are grounded in like a kernel of truth somewhere, right?
Yes.
And the kernel of truth with this is historically that was correct, but has not been correct for quite some time, and certainly is not true or not something that people need worry about with modern IUDs.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. This one has to do with like the expulsion, if potentially that mm-hmm. were to happen, but IUDs can float around your body or an IUD can get lost in your stomach, which, okay, I know that sounds crazy, but like mm-hmm. that's something I literally worried about before I talked to you.
So perforation of the IUD is a risk at time of insertion. I think the risk that we quote usually is about 1 in 1,000, mm-hmm. right? Risk of the IUD basically just getting pushed onto the other side of the uterus.
Yes.
Now the main risk associated with that is that it may not be preventing pregnancy quite mm-hmm. as well as it would have otherwise. The IUD otherwise doesn't tend to cause actually any problems. Mm. But it does mean that sometimes we would have to go in laparoscopically to fish this guy out.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
In part because she's not doing her job mm-hmm. if she's not sitting inside your uterus, providing that local effect that prevents pregnancy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that is a minor laparoscopic procedure. It is mm-hmm. something that people have to have done on occasion.
Okay.
For the most part, they don't tend to be like floating way up in crazy places. They do tend, when the expulsion or when perforation happens, they tend to stay pretty local.
Okay.
But there's plenty of room for weird and wonderful and different experiences with respect to that.
And that's usually like your highest risk is during the insertion process.
Yeah, yeah.
Or within a couple days around then.
Well, they don't tend to like migrate out.
Okay.
Right? So usually the thought generally is mm-hmm. that at the time of insertion, they were pushed through.
It went through.
Now it's possible. I've certainly known people, a friend in particular, who didn't know that her IUD was perforated and not in her uterus until she went to have it removed. And so that is a story that can occur, but I can't like speak to every single circumstance, but in general, I would say that that probably suggests that that happened at the time of insertion.
Okay.
As opposed to like the IUD, like wiggling its way through the uterus over time.
So you think the whole time it was probably not in the uterus.
No. Okay. And sometimes we think that maybe if it like partially perforates or if it like nicks into the wall of the uterus, then maybe and that can kind of migrate out over time. But a well-placed IUD should not migrate out.
And how does the uterus, like, let's say you're that one in 1,000 person that, you know, it does. How does your uterus recover from this? Is it okay? Do you have a higher risk of miscarriages in the future? No. Anything like that?
No. You have a higher risk of pregnancy, potentially.
Right. Because the IUD is not there.
It wants to be. Although, again, the hormonal IUDs in particular do tend, because they work in a very multifactorial way. That's less about just making the intrauterine environment hostile.
Okay.
For many people, they may, in fact, still work, even if they're just outside of the uterus.
Wow.
But I would say there is not an association that I know of that is very strong that you're at any risk of increased issues in the future. It's just crappy that you have to go get this IUD fished out.
Okay. Here's another one. You can't use an IUD or get an IUD if you haven't had a baby.
No. I mean, I think in the past we used to say that maybe IUDs were for people who'd had babies before, because it can be more uncomfortable, definitely, to have the IUD inserted before you've had a baby. But all of our major guidelines support IUD use regardless of obstetrical history. And I can tell you, we insert them even in teenagers very frequently. Yeah. And I once bullied a teenager, my sister, into getting an IUD because she had contraindications to a birth control pill. And so I was like, I'm sorry, you must get an IUD. And she has had several IUDs. I think she might be on her third IUD now.
She's very
happy with that decision. Now, I will say, as somebody who's had a like nulliparous IUD insertion, so before I ever got pregnant, and then had that IUD taken out, got pregnant, had a baby, got an IUD put in again.
Yes.
My IUD insertion was like legendarily difficult.
Post-baby?
Pre-baby.
Oh, pre-baby.
Pre-baby. Yeah, yeah. Okay. It was like, I was convinced I was not going to have a vaginal delivery because of how hard it was to get through my cervix. Postpartum?
Yeah. Next
30
level.
Seconds? I don't know. Easy. I had one of one of our physician assistants put it in. My first IUD took two OBGYNs, two subspecialized OBGYNs to put it in.
Wow.
And we were just so like, and guys, don't stress. Like in any other patient, anyone would have quit way sooner. I was bound and determined to get this IUD. And even I was forced to give informed consent multiple times as we continued to trying to insert this.
Yeah.
Postpartum, our PA did it in like, I don't know, 30 seconds.
So, while you're talking about your postpartum experience, let's quickly, I just want to quickly touch on this. Postpartum, let's say you are like, absolutely, I want to get an IUD postpartum. Can you get that inserted right after you have the baby? Do you need to wait 6 to 8 weeks? What's that process look like? What do you recommend?
No, so you can get an IUD inserted immediately after delivery, right? Okay. And some people do. I will say that the risk of expulsion or the IUD falling out is much higher in that time frame.
Yeah.
But certainly that's right for some people, right? Okay. Is to like have a baby and immediately have your IUD put in.
Yeah.
And as long as we're aware that there is a high risk of expulsion, just as your uterus shrinks back down to normal, then I think that that is reasonable for some patients, right? In certain contexts. I would say most people, we aim to insert the IUD somewhere between, you know, 6 weeks postpartum to even like 12 weeks postpartum.
Okay. Just so that uterus has had time to shrink back down to its original size.
Exactly.
And cervix and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Decreasing the chance of expulsion.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Perfect. Okay. I have one last misconception that I want to touch on, but it's that IUD removal can hurt more than the actual insertion.
So listen, I'm sure that there's people out there who have experienced a really uncomfortable removal.
Yeah.
And certainly there are cases where the strings of the IUD may be cut too short. And it is difficult to remove the IUD.
That happened
to me.
Oh no.
That can definitely cause additional discomfort with the IUD removal.
Yeah.
And very infrequently, we may even have to take someone to the operating room just to put a camera up into the uterus. No cuts, nothing crazy.
Yeah.
But to be able to pull out the IUD that way.
Yeah.
But for the most part, IUD removal, it's a lot easier going out than coming out than going back in. Mm-hmm. And so we usually just grab the strings and it's like a 5-second procedure. Yeah.
And guys, do not attempt this at home by yourself. I've seen videos, like YouTube videos of these influencers doing it themselves, which like, I understand why you want to do it yourself. It's easier, but I think it's important to have this done by a professional.
The caution that I would do, and I will say, I also know several OBGYNs who pulled out their own IUD. It did cross my mind, should I do this myself?
When
I pulled out my first one to conceive. But because of those, that like fainty kind of response that can happen anytime we manipulate the cervix, right? Even without putting instruments on it and things like that, pulling out an IUD can make people feel like they're going to faint or even occasionally faint.
And you don't want to be alone in that situation.
That is my main caution, honestly. It's not that you can like do major damage to yourself trying to pull out your own IUD for the most part, right?
Yeah.
But it's that like it can cause that kind of reaction and it can be unpredictable. And the last thing you want to do is like be trying to pull it out in the shower or something like that and then faint
and fall and no one's
exactly you don't want to have like secondary issues from IUD removal.
Just book an appointment. It'll be a quick easy hopefully appointment. Fingers crossed.
Exactly.
Okay, so now let's talk about the hormonal versus the copper a little bit more. Just because I know I've heard a lot about copper IUDs not being almost not prescribed as much as hormonal, but for some people, it's still an option that they want to consider because it is hormone free, which I understand is important to some people. But something I heard specifically about copper IUDs is that they can cause more painful periods too. And I'd love for you to kind of talk about the differences there a little bit. And
right on all counts. You're right on all counts. So the short answer too is that especially if we're using this specifically for contraception, there may be features of people's medical history that makes me more likely to recommend one IUD versus a different IUD, right? But for many people, it kind of falls into like their goals and their values and what they think is important to them with respect to like their periods in general, right?
Yeah.
So the copper IUD, as you mentioned, has the benefit of not having any hormonal mediated side effects, right? However, it does cause heavier bleeding and more cramping, especially at first, right? And that heavy bleeding and cramping is the most common reason for stopping the copper IUD or having us be asked to take it out. Copper IUDs, and that's to the tune of about, depending on whether we're looking at heavy bleeding or pain and the study that we looked at, the likelihood of having pain or heavy bleeding is 2.5 to 4 times higher with the copper IUD.
Yeah, wow, that's a big difference.
Yeah, so listen, for people for whom being on a non-hormonal method is important, right? Maybe they've had like really bad experiences with side effects from birth control pills or other hormonal methods of contraception, and they have fairly light to moderate, easy to manage periods with like minor cramping to moderate cramping.
Then maybe it's a good option.
They may be a great candidate, right? For a copper IUD, right? Whereas some of the side effects and benefits of the hormonal IUD, the levonorgestrel, for the first 1 to 3 months, irregular spotting, super common. And I would even extend that up to 6 months, I often see. That typically isn't heavy bleeding. Usually that is much more in the realm of like nuisance bleeding. So spotting little bits of pink
just
or red when you wipe
kind of
on the panty, on your underwear, on the panty liner, over time, the bleeding does get lighter, and most many people end up with very light periods or even no period at all. So by 3 years, about 40% of people with the Mirena, I think IUG specifically, have no periods at all. Right. And that again, that's perfectly safe to have. When we are treating your lining with a method like the IUD.
So it's the lining doesn't need to be shed.
Exactly. It is not important for your uterine health. You do not need to have a period in that context for any kind of long-term health reason. It doesn't impact your fertility to not have a period. And that's kind of like a nice benefit of, especially for people for whom bleeding is a problem.
And I do want to note, because we did have this question asked on our frequently asked question episode, was someone said, why am I still getting my period with the Mirena IUD? And unfortunately, like you said, 40% of people won't get a period or will have a much lighter period. you're probably part of
some
that
people
60%.
Are still going to have it.
Yeah. Right? It's unfortunate. I wish everyone just, you know, didn't have a period, but some people do enjoy still having a period.
I will say too, it's cumulative. Like some people continue having a period for the first year, but then by the second year, more people join them. By the third year, more people join them. And so and certainly that was my experience the first time I had the IUD. Yeah. I did end up being amenorrheic, so I didn't have a period, but it was an annoyingly long time. I think it was like 2.5 years or something
before
it just stopped for me. Mm-hmm. And that worked out to be the timing to approximately when I took it out to try to conceive. So that's annoying.
Yeah, yeah.
And now I'm back to having a light period every month with my new IUD. Yeah. So
I've been kind of, you know, pretty much no period at all. And I have the Kylina, which is pretty great. I hate to say, but I'm just loving it. I mean, sometimes I'll get some light spotting, but that's it. And that's why I love it. I like can't even remember the last time I bought tampons.
Oh my God. Glorious. Glorious.
Which is
love
so nice.
Listen, for some people, having a period every month is something that they find a lot of grounding in, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For some people, it gives them reassurance of like a lack of pregnancy, right? Mm-hmm. And so again, this is not us saying like you shouldn't have a period, right? Yeah. But rather that like you don't have to have one if you don't want to, right? Yes. And to be without a period, especially if we're like on one of these methods, is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't mean that anything is wrong. In fact, it means that it's working quite well.
And then when we're talking about the hormonal ones, from what I understand, the IUD has local hormones, like it's localized to the uterus. Mm-hmm. So are you still having those symptoms that might be, you know, your whole body, like what you might have with the pill. So acne, mood changes, all that kind of stuff. Does that still happen with the hormonal IUD?
Listen, you absolutely still can, right? But you're right that most of the effect is local, right? So with a birth control pill, you're taking the pill orally. It goes into your bloodstream via your stomach, right? It's absorbed into your bloodstream. It circulates through your body and ultimately reaches the target organ, right? With the IUD, it sits there from the beginning, right? And so while some is absorbed through the bloodstream, we're kind of missing that effect of having it go everywhere else in order to be delivered to the target organ. Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, the side effect profile does tend to be less than with an oral method of birth control.
Yeah.
However, again, like you still can get side effects like headache, nausea, breast tenderness, some mood changes associated with the IUD. Mm-hmm. Acne is rare, but it is reported with the levonorgestrel.
Yes.
I've also seen, I think, two patients in my practice ever potentially have some like hair loss associated with it.
Okay.
But again, these are like kind of the rare side effects of them, not something that is experienced generally. And I would say the vast majority of my patients experience cramping intermittently and spotting, and that's kind of it with respect to the IUD, the hormonally based IUD.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good to know. Cause I actually experienced a lot of acne when I got my IUD, but I wasn't sure if that was because I'd stopped birth control. I don't know. There was all these things but you still can experience some of those side effects. They just hopefully will be less than if you were taking a hormonal birth control pill.
Listen, the data is not supportive of saying that like you don't experience those side effects or no one experiences those side effects.
Yeah.
But I think the thing to be reassured by, I hope, is that like you're much less likely to experience those side effects with the IUD than with a pill that you take by mouth.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Are there any other, let's kind of go into the risks and anything rare events that might happen, like the perforation. Like just talk about those stats a little bit quickly for people who might want to know that.
Exactly. So the risk of perforation we kind of talked about already. That's of the IUD being pushed through the uterus to the other side. That is about 1 in 1,000 insertions.
Okay.
And it's slightly higher if you're early postpartum or if you're breastfeeding because of the impact on the uterus in those cases. Mm-hmm. And again, almost all perforations will never give like a universal statement, but the vast majority of perforations are thought to happen at the time of insertion, not later.
Yes.
So you don't have to worry about like your IUD that's been there for 5 years suddenly migrating out to another area in your body.
Yeah.
Now, expulsion is a little bit more common, right? Mm-hmm. And what that means is just that the IUD falls out, right? Mm-hmm. That stat is around 3-ish%.
Okay.
And it's certainly higher in people who have heavy periods to begin with, okay, again, or postpartum patients, right? Mm-hmm. Especially if the IUD is inserted like immediately postpartum.
Okay.
And the main concern with that would be, again, if it's expulsed and you don't notice, mm-hmm, you could be at risk of pregnancy. Mm-hmm. If it's expulsed and we had put it in to treat heavy bleeding, then mm-hmm, obviously that kind of leaves us without a solid option to, absolutely, treat your heavy bleeding, yeah, right? Mm-hmm. The last thing as well is of infection, right?
Yeah.
And this is kind of in the realm of pelvic inflammatory disease, mm-hmm, right? Which is a category of infections of the genital organs or the gynecologic, mm-hmm, organs, that can be associated with things like STIs, right? Mm-hmm. Like gonorrhea, chlamydia, but can also be associated with plenty of like more garden variety bacterial sources of infection, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So things that have nothing to do with sexual activity whatsoever.
Yeah.
Now, the thought with IUD is that it's not that an IUD is a source of infection,
yeah,
right? Because ultimately it's inert. It's,
yeah,
it's a like inactive,
yeah,
like sterile piece of equipment, yeah, that's not really designed to be able to like host a bacterial colony, mm-hmm, right? But the thought is that if somebody has an untreated, unknown STI at the time of insertion, mm, that we could kind of provide almost like a pathway
to get into the uterus
mm-hmm, through the insertion of the IUD at that time.
Yeah.
And
introduce it into the uterus that way.
Exactly. Exactly. The increased risk really for PID is within the first 20 days after insertion.
Okay.
And so again, this is not something that we think that like if you had an infection, mm-hmm, 5 years later, was it caused by the IUD? Mm-hmm. You know, not to say that we can like comment on every person's scenario, but yeah, like really the increased risk is thought to be at the time of insertion,
yeah,
because of this question of like an infection or like bacteria, mm-hmm, that are just kind of in the neighborhood being provided a doorway, okay, into the gynecologic organs.
Okay. Good to know. Perfect. And then, I guess let's just move on to what to expect in that first month of after, mm-hmm, you've had your IUD insertion. Because I think we've kind of gone over the risks and the scary stuff that no one wants to hear about, but we have to talk about.
So Sid, what's the like usual experience with IUD insertion?
Yeah. So I mean, I can also speak from my experience because I had pretty much every symptom that you can have in the first little while, but cramping and spotting are, mm-hmm, huge after you have the IUD. It can happen up to 6 months, mm-hmm, after having your IUD inserted. And I would say the worst cramping was in the first, mm-hmm, few days after, mm-hmm, having the, mm-hmm, IUD inserted. And then it was kind of more sporadic cramping here and there.
Yeah.
And just spotting. Like I was just that annoying spotting, like we said earlier, that you have a little bit in your underwear, or I found I had to just always have a liner on because I was just constantly spotting.
Yeah, super annoying.
I will say, I don't know if this is like usual or if you even know, but, mm-hmm, with my second IUD, I didn't experience the spotting like I did with the first one, which I, mm-hmm, thought was kind of interesting. And a pleasant surprise.
Yeah.
Because they do counsel you and say that can still happen every time you get an IUD,
but perhaps, mm-hmm, like your endometrium was just kind of stable at its like thin layer at the time that the reinsertion happened.
Exactly. Yeah. Which was nice. So, but that's something that would be the main thing to expect.
Yeah.
The other thing that I want you to touch on too is, getting an ultrasound done. I've had an ultrasound, I think not with my first one, but with my second one at that 6 week mark.
Yeah.
Is that something that's routinely done? Do you know?
Yeah, it absolutely can be. So usually we recommend some form of check-in, mm-hmm, at about 6 weeks to ensure that we think that the IUD is well placed.
Right.
Ultrasound, I think the availability of an ultrasound to check placement, mm-hmm, probably varies across the country.
Right.
I can speak to kind of like our metropolitan like experience, right? Which is that usually I'll offer my patients either. Like I'll offer either like for them to come back and do a string check with me. So I'll do a speculum exam just to ensure that the strings are
visible,
that it seems like it's well placed.
Mm-hmm.
Or an ultrasound to actually look at where the IUD is within the uterine cavity.
Yeah.
And so like sometimes if somebody had like a difficult insertion, as a gynecologist, I'm a little bit bolder sometimes with like the people that I'll put IUDs in, yes, right? Knowing yeah. like with appropriate counseling, knowing yeah. that I can handle complications. And so if somebody had, for instance, a bunch of fibroids that yeah. I thought might make it more likely that it might be malplaced or perforated, yeah. sometimes I'll recommend an ultrasound afterwards.
Just to check on it.
Just to check in. But usually an ultrasound is not necessarily like necessary, mm-hmm. especially if it's like a huge hassle to get the ultrasound, and it's far easier to just yep. come in and have your strings checked with your provider.
Yes. And while we're talking about string checks, I know mm-hmm. like some people say to check your strings every month, but now I've heard that the advice is actually to not check your strings all the time. What do you counsel your patients for string checks?
I hope I'm not out of date with this. We'll have to double check.
Do you still say to check them? Is that why?
I yeah. kind of give people, like, again, I don't expect a well-placed IUD to migrate, yeah. right? And yeah. so I'll say to check them every now and again. I don't okay. give people necessarily like check every X month.
I think
months.
That's right. Yeah. That's what I've also yeah. seen. Yeah.
I usually want my patients though to be familiar with how it feels.
Right.
So that we can tell if it does fall out at yep. some point. Because that's actually what I'm more worried about is not right. that it's going to like, you know, perforate through the uterus much later. Mm-hmm. But especially if I'm treating bleeding with my IUD, like heavy bleeding, mm-hmm. I want to make sure my patients know what it feels like so that they can know if it falls out, mm-hmm. right? Or know if we're not sure where it is anymore.
Right.
And so I do advocate for string checks for that reason, at least to like be familiar with your own anatomy and yes. to get a sense of where it is. And so string checks for context too, would basically mean inserting, you know, one or two fingers inside of the vagina, feeling up to the cervix and actually being able to feel the string in and around mm-hmm. the cervix. Mm-hmm. Initially after the IUD is inserted, it might feel a little bit more firm.
Yeah.
But eventually it tends to wrap around the cervix and feel much more like dental floss.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And don't be alarmed right away if you don't feel it. Because no. sometimes, like you said, it can get wrapped up in a yeah. funny position, or depending on, you know, where yeah. your cervix is, it can be a little bit harder to find than other
yeah.
times.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would just caution people to not, I mean, it's of course important to get it checked yeah. out if you can't feel the strings,
yeah,
but
yeah.
also don't panic that it maybe
definitely
has
don't panic.
Fallen out or moved, because yeah. probably likely it hasn't. It's just, you can't feel it.
Yeah. That's just as a reason to come and see your provider and
yeah.
we'll have a look and see what's going on.
Exactly.
Now, as far as like red flags mm-hmm. after an IUD is inserted, here would be times when I would want to like hear from my own patients or have them call the clinic. Mm-hmm. First of all, again, bleeding spotting normal afterwards, but you yeah. should really never be bleeding so much that you're like, it's like a heavy period.
Yeah.
You're changing multiple pads an hour or passing really large clots.
Yes.
Similarly, I expect the pain to get better and not worse mm-hmm. after an IUD insertion. Mm-hmm. Certainly like a few days of like annoying cramping and then kind of like phantom cramping, right?
Yeah.
So like random sharp cramping throughout the month
yeah.
is expected.
That's
in the
normal.
First few months after an IUD.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't expect that the pain would be like worse day to day to day in the immediate mm-hmm. time after insertion. And yeah. I would certainly want somebody to come and see me, or I would direct them to the emergency department
yeah.
just to make sure that there was no complications that were occurring, like infection.
Yeah. Yeah.
Similarly, on that note, if you have fever, if mm-hmm. you have chills, if you have foul smelling discharge from the vagina, those can be indicative of an infection yeah. that is brewing.
Yeah.
If you suspect pregnancy. So one of the yeah. complications, or one of the side effects, I suppose, of the IUD that we didn't talk about
yeah.
Yet is that IUDs do have a pregnancy in the context of an IUD is yeah. more likely to be ectopic
yes.
than a pregnancy outside of the context of an IUD.
Yeah. Yeah.
That does not mean that IUDs put you at a higher risk of ectopics.
Mm.
But basically, IUDs overall put you at a much lower risk of ectopics because they put you at a dramatically lower risk of pregnancy.
It's
one of our most effective forms of contraception.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But if you are to get pregnant, that mm-hmm. pregnancy is more likely to be ectopic.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it is in part because of the way that the IUD works. And remember, we talked earlier about those slowing of those cilia, those mm-hmm. little hairs within the tubes. Mm-hmm. That can mean that it is a little bit more likely for a pregnancy to implant in one of those tubes.
Right.
Especially.
Yeah.
And so if you have signs of pregnancy, mm-hmm. It's important to get an ultrasound if you have an IUD in mm-hmm. to ensure that that pregnancy is not ectopic.
Right. Yeah, which is super important.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, Sid, I think that more or less wraps us up, hey?
I think we've hit everything. I know that, guys, I know that was a lot, mm-hmm. but I feel like there's so much to talk about IUDs, and I hope that that was helpful. Like, I feel like it was. And again, it's not to scare anyone.
No.
It's hopefully, like, I explained my experience, which was hard. Like, it was hard. Yeah. But I would do it again because I do, like you said, it's an effective form of birth control, which for me is what I'm using it as right now. And then it also provided me some other benefits, like having no period.
Yeah.
So there's so many reasons why you can have an IUD inserted and it can be a positive experience. You know, talk to your providers, like we suggested here, talk about pain management routes. And I hope it gave you some tips that you can use if you are considering getting one, or maybe it gave you a reason not to get one, and that's okay too.
That is fine too.
It's just good to know what's out there, 100%. Right?
100%. And you know what I always reflect on too, Sid? Like my first IUD insertion was objectively horrible.
Yeah.
Again, like I traumatized my own OBGYNs.
Yes.
With my cervix of steel and our inability. Both of them were texting me for days afterwards to make sure I was good. Okay.
Yeah.
Again, I had an objectively horrible first IUD experience.
Yes.
And I still felt fine about it afterwards and marched back there postpartum from my second IUD, which doesn't speak to any inherent toughness with me. I don't really think I'm any tougher than anybody else, and maybe less so, honestly. But I think that kind of goes a little bit to how important the psychological factors are in our experience of pain as a whole. Right?
Oh, yeah.
And the fact that I knew what to expect, that I knew all of this information going in because I have had to learn it for my job.
Yes.
I really can't understate, I don't think, how much that helped me.
Yeah.
Both with like getting it done as a practice and also with feeling okay about having like a hard IUD experience.
Yes.
And not being too traumatized to go back for a second. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what we're looking to provide for you guys is like, if we can give our knowledge to you to help protect against like a traumatic IUD experience,
even
when it sucks.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Then that is honestly like, I think the best way that we can utilize this information, right? And I think again, it speaks to like how much these discussions are so important to any kind of like procedure. We do.
That's the, right. Like we say in almost every single episode, you know, talk to your provider, make sure you're asking your questions. You're building a plan of care that feels right for you. Because everyone's different and it's important to take time to answer those questions and to make sure you feel good before going into it.
Yeah.
And weirdly enough, I will recommend getting an IUD inserted on your period because for some reason for me, it was way better on my period.
And I would recommend everyone get an IUD postpartum if you don't want to be pregnant right away.
Because
like the difference.
Yeah.
Oh my God. It was nothing postpartum.
So much easier.
It was nothing postpartum. At least in my limited experience.
Yeah.
It was like.
No, that's like most people I've talked to. That's how they feel too.
It was so good postpartum.
Yeah.
But listen, really the takeaway here is not run out and get an IUD, but it's that like we don't want the only source of information for IUDs to be like TikTok horror stories.
Yes.
And the right IUD placed under the right circumstances, right, with the right information can fit really seamlessly into your life and provide you really unparalleled protection against pregnancy.
And I think we're moving towards better care in terms of IUD insertions.
I feel like
it's better than it was. And hopefully we're inching towards every provider giving options like you do and inserting it the way you do. But it's out there. It's better than it was. So don't listen to all of those horror stories. I feel like they're not helpful, especially if it's something you're considering, because a lot of those people, it might be the 1 in 1,000 that experience, you know, perforation or something like that. And that's not common. So.
Totally.
Yeah.
But listen, tell us your horror stories in the comments, I guess.
Yeah.
Tell us if you feel like we're wrong. Let us know what your experience was like. Mm-hmm. Do you love your IUD? Do you hate your IUD? Do you have a copper IUD? Do you have a hormonal IUD?
Yes.
Do you have not a T IUD?
Oh, yeah. Like what?
We have lots of international listeners from lots of different, I mean, Canada really is like only like 25%, I think, of our listeners.
Yeah.
So for anybody listening from somewhere else, we would love to hear about
absolutely.
Your
IUD. So make sure you follow us on TikTok and Instagram at the.push.podcast because we can talk to you guys there. DM us. We post a lot of stuff on our stories as well that you can follow along with new episodes. But we release a new episode every Wednesday. I hope everyone's doing well. I hope everyone enjoyed this episode. And happy holidays because it's December 1st when we're filming this. So
we will see you next time.
Bye.